It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ticks are out earlier this year across the country, and they're on the move here in Wisconsin.
Nationwide, people are visiting emergency rooms for tick bites at the highest rate seen in almost a decade. That's according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
In Wisconsin, for the week ending May 10th, 53 out of every 10,000 ER visits were related to tick bites. That's on pace with last year at this time, but at the end of April, there was a big jump in ER visits from ticks. The weekly data is from the State Health Department's Wisconsin Tick Bite Tracker.
Ticks can spread viruses, parasites, and Lyme disease bacteria, causing infections in people. Wisconsin's traditionally been among the states with the most Lyme disease cases.
For a look at the early surge in tick bites this year, we're joined by Lyric Bartholomé, professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison, and director of the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease. Lyric, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thanks for showcasing this important issue in Lyme Disease Awareness Month here in May.
Why are scientists seeing the number of tick bites surge so early in the season?
I think what we're seeing this year is that there was some unseasonably warm weather in March that really woke up those ticks. So a tick is relatively cold hardy, and they can start to be active around 40 or 45 degrees. So when it gets that warm, they're out and about and interacting with folks. And, you know, we were all pretty desperate to get out and about, too.
Emergency room visits for tick bites are surging in parts of the country. You've seen the map, specifically the Northeast, the Midwest. What does that mapping indicate to you?
I think that tracks with what we're seeing in terms of tick numbers that are out and active. So it makes sense, and it suggests that people are tuned in and paying attention to the fact that they're being exposed to ticks, and also that they feel pretty vulnerable and feel that the emergency room is the place they need to go when they need to get a tick off.
So with an early start to tick season and these emergency room visits, what does that mean for public health?
The ticks that we were seeing in the most, in the highest numbers were the tick that we would call the wood tick typically in Wisconsin. The scientific name for that tick is Dermacentor variabilis. That's a tick that tends to really not transmit a lot of disease to people in Wisconsin, so less of a threat in terms of public health. But it did bring to light that ticks are out, and the ticks that are most important in public health in Wisconsin are the black-legged tick or deer tick. A lot of people call them deer ticks, and the scientific name for that one is Ixodes scapularis. So we're tracking that one, too. We, as a Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease here at the UW-Madison and with our colleagues at the Department of Health Services, we're tracking ticks and seeing that the numbers of ticks are sort of declining, the adult ticks, and we can expect that in the next couple of weeks we'll start to see more of the nymph stage of tick. That's the one that's the real public health threat.
Yeah, can you explain that distinction and the cycle of life for ticks and whether these adults or these nymphs, larvae, what stage is really that we should pay attention to?
Right. So a tick starts out as an egg, becomes a larva, and then has to take blood, and then becomes a nymph, and then has to take blood, and then becomes an adult, and likewise needs blood. And that whole process for a lot of ticks can take 2 to 3 years. So they're out and about for a long time. So the ticks we're encountering this spring have been in the environment for a while, right? The ticks that are most important to us in public health are the black-legged ticks, as I mentioned, or deer ticks. And the nymph stage got infected with bacteria or viruses that you mentioned when they were the larva. So they feed on a little mouse, they come down with an infection, and then they have it in their bodies when they become a nymph. And that nymph stage is about the size of a poppy seed. Okay. So they're really tiny. And that's really the problem, Kate, is that they just go undetected. You know, they could be hiding at your hairline or in your armpit or, you know, in various places in your body. And they're so, so small. They're like freckle sized that they often go without notice.
With the deer ticks you mentioned, adult deer ticks, they've spread from the North Woods, I understand, to all parts of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. How is the public health risk changing with that spread across Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think the spread has been really well documented by Dr. Susan Paskowitz's lab in the Department of Entomology. She and I run this Midwest Center of Excellence for Vectorborne Disease together. And back in the 90s, she started tracking that tick in Wisconsin and watched it radiate out. And I think there's a few implications there. That means that people in the North Woods, so to speak, are perhaps more accustomed to seeing the ticks, and maybe physicians are more accustomed to seeing and detecting Lyme disease. And some of the places that were invaded more recently, there may be less awareness there.
We're talking with Lyric Bartholomew, professor in the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison, about the early season for tick activity in Wisconsin and nationwide. Lyric, turning to Lyme disease, Wisconsin is lit up on the map of Lyme disease cases in the U.S. for about the last two decades or so. Why does Wisconsin's case rate surpass other places in the Midwest and rival the northeastern U.S.?
That's right. Thanks for highlighting that. I think a lot of times people think about Lyme disease as a northeastern sort of New England state kind of disease, but it really is just as problematic here in Wisconsin as it is in the Northeast. And so that, I think, is really a function of us having this beautiful habitat for ticks. The things that we enjoy about Wisconsin are things that ticks likewise enjoy. So, you know, the beautiful deciduous forests are great habitat for the ticks to lie around on the ground or to find a little mouse to latch on to. They're also great places for the ticks to find a deer, and the deer are really important for the adults to take blood and lay big batches of eggs. And so it's sort of this perfect storm of conditions that make it really optimal habitat for the tick. And then people want to be in those places too. And so we go into those places where the ticks are and encounter the ticks. And increasingly, Kate, what our research is showing is that it's not actually just the woods where people are encountering ticks. We have a mobile health app that we'd love people to join on called the Tick App. And through the Tick App, we've learned that Wisconsinites love to be outdoors. They love to be tending their gardens. And increasingly, people are encountering ticks in their backyards. So
even in urban spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
How is our warming climate affecting tick activity?
Tick activity is really dependent, like I said, on the presence of the right habitat, so the forested areas. Mm-hmm. It's really dependent on the mice thriving and the deer thriving. And so climate certainly can play in some ways, but maybe it's less obvious than the ways that climate perhaps impacts, like mosquitoes.
Hmm. What kinds of tick-borne illness symptoms should people look out for?
Oh, thanks for that question. It's just such a good time to start thinking about this because we're going into a holiday weekend. The stage of the tick that is most likely to go undetected will start to come out more often. And so it would be great for people to be aware and think about if they've been outdoors in the late part of May, beginning of June, and they're feeling fatigued, sometimes like a stiff neck, perhaps if they see a rash on their bodies, those could be hallmark symptoms of Lyme disease.
We've been noting that Wisconsin's tick tracker from the State Health Department provides this weekly data. What data are you tracking? Are you collecting ticks? Mm-hmm. How do you keep track of what's happening in our state?
Yeah. So really that was work that, again, was started by Dr. Susan Paskowitz. And now it's continued by the Department of Health Services by Dr. Zia Lee, who's our state medical entomologist. Wisconsin's really fortunate to have somebody in that role where they can be the expert who's going out and doing the sampling. And so Dr. Lee works with some students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison here and with our center. They go out to sites, three different sites in counties across Wisconsin, and regularly sample so that we have year after year understanding of what ticks are out and when and how many. And through the Tick App and through the Department of Health Services website, people can tune us in to the fact that they've had a tick on them so they can take a picture and send it in, and we can identify it. And we can use that information then to understand who's seeing ticks and from where.
That must be really valuable.
Invaluable data, right?
Yeah.
Year after year. So that's very helpful.
There, you know, what are some of the effective ways for people to protect themselves from tick bites? I would imagine, you know, when you're outside and coming back in, you search your whole body.
That's right.
Any other tips?
Yeah, I think ticks are off-putting, maybe we could say. Mm-hmm. And it might not be somebody's ideal to come back in and search their bodies for them. And they're hard to find.
Yeah.
We find that people are more likely to see ticks if they're on the upper parts of their bodies, and the ticks might be on the lower part of your body. So one of the recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control is to disrobe and take a shower and use a washcloth or a loofah or something like that and scrub your skin and get the ticks off that way. Mm. So that's key prevention, is to never let the ticks actually get their mouth parts in you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, preceding that, there are ways that you can keep the ticks off of you. Our field teams, we use a permethrin spray that we put on our clothing. So we know our folks are going to be wearing the same clothes every day. They're light-colored clothes so that you can see the ticks. We spray them with this insecticide and repellent called permethrin. You put that on the clothes, and you can wash them up to 6 times, and they're still going to repel and kill ticks. So that's a really good way, is to have your clothing that you're regularly wearing out in your garden treated. You can also take the approach of sporting the fashion we wore in the 1980s and shove your pants into your socks. And then the ticks can't crawl up your legs. We recommend you tuck in your shirt so they can't get on you that way. Mm-hmm. Some people are talking about using lint rollers to get ticks off before they come inside. And I would say doing that, and then also doing that for your pets, is a really important way to keep ticks out of your household and away from your family.
Lyric, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lyric Bartholomew is professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison and director of the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease. We talked with her about the surge in tick-related ER visits across the country and what it means for Wisconsin.
Coming up, the head of the Universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents joins the show with a look at the next steps to replace the ousted system president.
We are looking for a leader that has many qualities, including some political astuteness, consensus building, someone who's transparent and very collaborative.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Community-supported agriculture first gained popularity in the 1990s.
It's a way for people to support local farmers by paying upfront for boxes of produce that are delivered throughout the growing season.
But today's food system caters to both convenience and choice. As WPR's Hope Kerwin reports for Harvest Public Media, that's put pressure on CSA farmers to offer people more buying options.
Patty Grimmer ticks off the trays of seedlings in one of the greenhouses on her farm in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, so we got peppers, we've got some lettuce mix that's going to be transplanted on our field, our tomatoes.
All of this produce will go to regional farmers markets, restaurants, and customers who signed up for a community-supported agriculture, or CSA, share. In most CSAs, members pay several hundred dollars at the start of the year and receive a weekly box of produce throughout the spring and summer. But Grimmer lets her members sign up for shorter time frames, as little as 1 month, and they can opt to pay as they go instead of all at once. Some old-school farmers may say that's not CSA, but Grimmer sees it as a needed evolution to the original model.
We're transitioning to a generation of convenience, of preference. You know, you can get your groceries delivered to you in a matter of hours while you sit on your couch and pick what you want to pick.
She's a part of a growing number of CSA farmers who are offering more flexibility to their members to keep up with consumer preferences. Sadie Willis is with Fair Share CSA Coalition, which serves farms throughout the Midwest. She says producers who are offering more flexibility still see themselves as supported by their community of customers.
Even if those customers are saying, hey, I want to pick up my box at my local brewery instead of having to drive over to your farm to get it, Or I don't like kohlrabi. Can you give me more spinach instead? So, like some of those components have come into play over time where consumers are being a little bit more choosy.
She says farms can use a number of online platforms to let CSA members swap out items in their weekly box. Producers can also shift to a credit system where customers load an online card at the start of the season and choose whether to buy something each week. But these customer conveniences move the model away from what it was meant to do for farms. John Hendrickson is a farm viability specialist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Back in the early 90s, he helped organize some of the first CSA memberships at farms in the Madison area. Hendrickson says traditionally, CSA was about people taking on the risk with farmers. But that doesn't work for every consumer.
You know, if the farm had a bad year and there were not as many tomatoes, then people got less tomatoes. You know, most consumers are not in a position to roll the dice on in terms of their food budget. And so that has really kind of fallen by the wayside.
He says CSA has always required more customer service than selling in bulk or at a market stand. Letting consumers customize their weekly box could create even more administrative work for a farmer who would rather be in their field. It's why some farmers, like Liz Graysneck in central Missouri, are taking a more conservative approach to customer flexibility. She lets her members pay in installments instead of upfront, but they don't have the option of canceling mid-season. Customers can tweak their weekly box when the farm has an abundance of a certain vegetable, but Graysneck says she's not interested in becoming a subscription service.
That does not fit what CSA is. You know, for me, CSA embodies eating seasonally, supporting the farm that is feeding you, and I'm not Amazon, you know?
She thinks farmers have to find the right balance between serving new kinds of customers and staying true to the whole point of community-supported farming. I'm Hope Kerwin, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including Wisconsin Public Radio. This is WPR News.
The search for the next president of the Universities of Wisconsin is underway after the system's Board of Regents fired former President Jay Rothman last month in a unanimous vote.
Rothman has stated that he was given no reason for his termination. Regents have disputed that claim, with two regents telling the legislature that there were substantial reasons for his firing and that Rothman was aware ahead of time.
Amy Bogus joins us to talk about how the state university system is moving forward. She's president of the Universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents. Regent Bogus, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's start with this search now for a new president on the Universities of Wisconsin. The Board of Regents announced the formation of the search committee just earlier this month. Big picture, what are you looking for in a system president?
We're excited, by the way, and we're looking for a transformative leader for the future of higher education in this state. We are looking for a leader that has many qualities, including some political astuteness, consensus building, someone who's transparent and very collaborative.
This is a tall job. There's a lot of constituencies to deal with, the Board of Regents, faculty, university chancellors, parents, students, alumni, donors, and, of course, the state government. Is there a person who could do this kind of job? This is a tall order, right?
It is a tall order. But yes, of course, there's a person that can do this job. I think these jobs are difficult, right? And I think it is imperative that person understands how to be collaborative, right? And understands higher education. I think it is a difficult job, but I think a leader that just understands just to build some consensus and have collaboration and be transformative, those are really ideal qualities for a candidate.
People may have been watching the headlines over the last few months and hearing some of the back and forth, but may not understand a very basic question. What is the job? What does the president of the system actually do?
Well, we have 13 universities in this state, and they are extremely important to the state. They are the economic of the engine of the state. They bring in billions of dollars, and our main purpose is to educate our state, right? Educate the people in this state. And the president oversees the 13 universities and works with the board to make sure that we have the highest quality product out there, that our students have success, that our businesses and partnerships are well established with our campuses. And it is a big role. And to meet with the political leaders of the state, business leaders of the state, faculty, students, staff, and we all understand the importance of how our universities provide so much to the state, and the president is really ensures the success of our campuses and universities.
I gave a long list of stakeholders there with an interest in who gets this job. What kind of things do you do in this process to make sure their concerns are met, their desires are heard, at least in this process?
Well, the committee itself is a start, right? We have 25 members on this committee representing 13 universities plus businesses, partnerships with community leaders. And that's why the committee is large, to take into consideration how we collaborate with the state. And that is really essential. We're going to have hearing from public forums, and there's going to be very many ways for the public to have input, ask questions, hear from the candidates themselves. And it's very important for the search that we have complete transparency as we go forward and continue to collaborate with the people of the state from all factions.
We have an interim director or interim president, UW-Superior Chancellor Renee Wachter. Can you talk a little bit about the decision to hire that particular chancellor?
This decision was made with a lot of thought and care. It was very, very important to the board to place someone in that role that understands the universities and understands the people of the universities, the students, the staff, and faculty, and everyone, including our stakeholders, right? And we picked Chancellor Wachter, now Interim President Wachter. She is the longest-serving chancellor in the system. She is extremely knowledgeable about the institutions. She is very well respected among her colleagues, as well as the people in the state, legislators, and people here at the system. And we're really excited. We're really focused on the future and really looking forward to her stepping into the role.
People might look at that and say, hey, UW-Superior, it's an important institution here, but it's a campus of, I think, less than 3,000 students. The system serves 165,000 students. This is just a very different scale of a job.
That's right. Her campus is small but very mighty, but her knowledge of this system and the universities and the campus and how well-respected she is going to bring so much focus and depth for transforming the future of the system, and we are really looking forward to her to be in this role. And as I said, she's extremely well-respected by every constituency that I've spoken to, so we're excited for her to start.
We're talking about the search for the next president of the Universities of Wisconsin with Amy Bogost, head of the UW Board of Regents, in charge of this search. I want to look at now the previous president of the system, Jay Rothman, asked to retire, ultimately fired over a month ago. A lot of questions raised about what led to that decision. Can you tell us a little more about what led the Regents ultimately to vote, with the understanding that there are some confidentiality issues with him as an employee? But I think people want to know more about why he was dismissed.
Well, I can tell you that it was a unanimous vote. The Board of Regents, this was not an easy decision. It was a unanimous decision, and we are moving forward and very future focused. So the board, as I said, it's a unanimous decision, and we are really looking forward and excited for the future of the universities.
Given the way lawmakers pushed back and others raised concerns, do you think the communication with the public could have been handled in a different way?
Given the sensitivity of these things, I don't think so. I think this is a highly sensitive issue. And as the message was sent out, that it was a unanimous decision of the board, and we are looking forward to moving forward, and everyone has a difference of opinion, and very, very not afraid to share those opinions with us. So taking the fact that it was unanimous, we're looking forward to moving on.
Former President Rothman wrote in an opinion piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, he thought there needed to be some changes in the Regents Board. One concern he had, and I understand this was a point of contention, was that he felt the Board of Regents and the president weren't always speaking with one voice. The notion that, hey, maybe one regent might tell a lawmaker something, another might say something. Is there something to that? Is there a need for more message discipline from the Board of Regents?
I think there's a difference of opinions, and I think that's healthy. As we move forward, we are a board of 18 people, and we, as I think the message was clear about our vote being unanimous, we have all sorts of different backgrounds, but in the end, we understand our fiduciary duty to the universities and the people of the state, and we work very well together. And I've been on the board for 6 years, and it's always so impressive because in the end, we understand what our mission is. It's the fiduciary duty of the universities.
Looking ahead again at the role of the next president now, they have to have a relationship with the Board of Regents, of course, and with the chancellors of each university. What are you looking for in that next leader and how they relate to the people leading very different campuses, in some cases with differing missions?
That is a very good question. And I think that the next leader we'll have to understand that every university in our system is different and brings different values, different assets to the state. And dealing with them, I think the person will have a very high emotional intelligence in how to deal with all sorts of leaders, not just chancellors, but understand what our mission is. And that's to serve the students, to serve these universities in the best possible way. And that is to be transparent and collaborative.
Another relationship is with the state legislature and the governor. We don't know who those leaders are going to be come next year. There are two poles here. The president has to have a good working relationship because these are the agencies that control the university budget in large part. But I think there's a sense that people worry that a leader of the university might roll over and be bullied by the legislature in differences of opinion. What are you looking for in that relationship?
Well, it's important for the new leader to understand the politics of the state, no matter what those politics are. It is also important to understand higher education and what is necessary for our campuses and the people on those on the campuses. And I think it's imperative that we know that we have to be transparent with the state and the people of the state. So it's a balance, right? It's a balance that our mission is to educate and our mission is to higher education, but it's also we have a duty to be transparent and collaborative with the state and the state budget, the governor, and the legislature. And whoever the new leader is has to understand that balance and serve the mission and make sure that's at the forefront of every dialogue they have with the legislature going forward.
A challenge facing higher education all over the country.
Absolutely.
A demographic change now with fewer people being born and fewer people going to college. How do you see the system navigating that? And I'm thinking especially the smaller campuses.
Right. And I think it's interesting that topic of a demographic cliff. This is something that's not been a surprise. I mean, right, we have a census that we've been counting for decades. So that's not a surprise. It's not a shock. And I think that we have a real opportunity here. There are, you know, it's been said over 800,000 people that have some time to degree but do not have a degree. There are veterans. There are people that, you know, older that want to finish their degree. We would love to take this opportunity to get even more people into our universities. It is an opportunity to really give these people a boost up and, you know, whether they have a job now and they want to improve their status, the universities welcome them, and we're trying to become more nimble to bring more people in. And we're excited for the opportunity because I think we can grow the universities.
Another cutting-edge issue, and this is something actually brought up by fellow Regent Tim Nixon, saying artificial intelligence is an issue. They want to see the University of Wisconsin president set guidelines on, take some action on. What do you see as the role of the system president in helping the individual campuses navigate this changing AI landscape?
Well, I think it is another opportunity because AI right now is critical. It's a pretty important time for us in education. And I think now more than ever, the president can assist in bringing in more students because what's needed is more critical thinkers for AI. We need to train people to understand what AI is and how to approach it. And with that, we must be graduating people that have critical thinking skills to understand what AI is and how to bring the best out in everywhere in the state with AI. So as far as guidelines, I think it's important that we understand it is changing rapidly. For us to have a set policy in AI right now would, you know, wouldn't work, and it would be irresponsible because things are changing so quickly. Of course, there are guardrails that I know the state has instituted and are instituting, but it's a constant. We are looking at this constantly to look at the change and what can we do to best support our universities. And that's what the new president will have to do as well.
Finally, one of the biggest changes in recent years in the UW system is the merger and then, in many cases, the closure of two-year campuses. And I've talked to people in some of the affected communities. They feel kind of abandoned by the system. What would you say to them to say, hey, we are still doing our best to serve you, even though those buildings, that campus is closed?
Right. It's an unfortunate situation. But we did our best when it did happen to support those students and ask them to continue their education at one of our other universities that was convenient for them. And we've done our best to support those people as best as we can under the circumstances.
Regent Bogost, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Amy Bogost is president of the Universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents. We've been talking about the future of UW and the quest to hire a new system president.
Coming up, visit Madison's new Center for Black Excellence and Culture and hear the founders' hopes for its impact.
This is really about mitigating a lot of the stress that comes from navigating predominantly white spaces when you are from a minoritized group.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Center for Black Excellence and Culture opened earlier this month in Madison. The founders describe it as a space built by Black minds, hearts, and hands that is a home for celebrating and cultivating global Black brilliance in all its forms.
The center includes spaces for women and seniors, as well as performance and meeting facilities.
There are also places to create art of all kinds and an innovation center to help entrepreneurs.
Reverend Alex G. is the center's president and CEO, and Dana Pelaban is the center's director of performing arts. Dana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Reverend G., welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Reverend G., this has been some time in the making. We talked to you a couple years back. Before we get into the details, what's it like to have this vision for the Center for Black Excellence and Culture become a reality?
It's surreal. The grand opening happened a little more than a week ago, and I'm still pinching myself. I think the turnout was historic. The building is phenomenally designed. And it feels like I'm still dreaming. The dream that I'm waiting to happen still feels like it hasn't fully happened because I feel like I'm still in the dream, but it is amazing.
Dana, paint us a picture, please. What will people see when they enter the space?
So, you know, imagine walking into a building that doesn't look like anything that you've ever seen before, with faces on the walls that you may have seen in the community, but didn't know what they meant to the community. In addition to art, so much art everywhere. And for me, walking into that space feels like walking into my home. As somebody that has grown up all over these United States, being able to walk into a place that feels like me, with the people on the walls that look like me, the people who are at the desk that speak like me, is Really an amazing experience here in Madison.
Reverend G, now that it is open and a reality, what are your hopes for the impact for the Center for Black Excellence and Culture for Black communities in the Madison area and around Wisconsin?
I say on a real macro level, it's expanded lifespans for Black people. I mean, although I love gathering Black people and Black music and Black celebrations, this is really about mitigating a lot of the stress that comes from navigating predominantly white spaces when you are from a minoritized group. And so my big dream is that this will pay dividends on Black wellness and Black health that will be documented and will provide empirical data that proves that when we have a sense of belonging, we celebrate and we thrive. I want there to be a place where the Black community feels that when Madison is spoken of, or Dane County, or Wisconsin for that matter, as one of the best places in the country to live, I want the Black community to say, yeah, you're right for everyone, including us. And then thirdly, I want the broader community to understand Black excellence from our lens and not a story that is somehow Black-faced. I want us to be able to tell the story of Black pride and Black wellness and Black excellence in a way that people know what we mean when we say this is what we've been missing here.
Dana, as the center's director of performing arts, what type of performances are you bringing to the center?
So, you know, we're going to be having a lot of different communities come in and do classes. I'm in talks with a puppeteer to come and do puppeteering and teach a class on that. We have Whoopin' Soccer, which is a program out of the UW School of Education that works with kids to write plays, and then we perform the plays that the kids write. We are working with the Children's Theater of Madison to have programming coming through for their shows. We are also looking at starting a theater company that is attached to the center. I know I have my first two plays picked out that I am doing in that space. And that's just the theatrical portion. There are comics that have come to see. There are musicians. There's so many people that are in our community that are so very excited to utilize these spaces to produce their art.
And Dana, what I'm hearing you say is this isn't just a space that, hey, somebody might go to watch a show. It sounds like a real key part that's baked in here is helping people unleash their own creative side, people from the community. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. So I've been doing theater here in this community for about 20 years. And part of the thing that I have always done is help artists realize their dreams. And now I have a directed space to advise, consult, make sure that they get what it is that they need so that they can produce their art in a space that feels comfortable for them.
We're talking about the new Center for Black Excellence and Culture. It opened this month in Madison. Reverend Alex G is the center's founder and CEO. Dana Pelleban is its director of performing arts. Reverend G, again, it's been a journey of some years. What were some of the biggest obstacles in making this thing a reality?
Probably about a decade ago, we put together planning teams to get to where we are today. A lot has happened in the world since 2017. There have been a couple of meaningful elections, COVID. And so when COVID hit, I thought all hopes of organizing communities to ask what this would look and feel like would be thwarted because we weren't meeting together. And so my initial planning meetings, meetings and fundraising meetings were on Zoom. So I was asking people for millions of dollars via a screen and not sitting together with handouts and poster boards that they could hold and feel. I think those are some of the major ones. As we were finalizing our dollars to close the gap, things changed again politically, and some of the dollars that were designated for us from the federal government through congressionally directed spending, those dollars were locked up. We were having trouble getting those dollars released with the invoices we were sending. Some nonprofits were told, these funds are rescinded, you will not be getting them at all. That was a very frightening time. So to come together, to put a campaign team together that only met each other in person in 2025. We've been meeting since 2020. We met in person all together for the first time 5 years later. So those are just some of the big struggles. And then having to downsize the center because of inflation and because of difficulty getting supplies. And so and really galvanizing the Black community was not difficult because we were excited to see something happen. But I just think the inability to have that personal energy and shared space and trying to convey the energy and the necessity of this virtually posed some real challenges because your technology and your energy had to be in sync.
Dana, you recently told an Isthmus newspaper in Madison you'd like the center to represent the culture that's been operating grassroots for years. How do you see things that are already existing in the area at that grassroots level finding a home and maybe finding extra attention at the center?
So, you know, again, as somebody that's been doing this for 20 years, whenever I want to do a show, I have to find a venue. I have to find investors. I've got to find space. And considering how many other performing arts organizations are in the area, a lot of that space just actually isn't available. And a lot of the spaces to perform arts, again, are not necessarily accessible. So, you know, we are a very get it done type of culture. And we have been doing shows in so many different venues from the Burr Oak to warehouses to backyards. And what we are doing at the center is giving a space. And having a space that's easy to connect with, that, again, as I have worked in a lot of these spaces, I have experienced racism. I have experienced harm. I have experienced audiences that don't know what to do with Black plays and don't know how to respond when you have an audience that talks back. You know, I remember a play I did years ago, and I had to talk to the actors to say, this is going to be a different kind of audience. And the audience should feel comfortable engaging with the play because that is culturally what it is that we do. So it is not just a space, it is a comfortability. It is an understanding that when we come into the space, that culturally, the things that we care about are taken care of in the space. And that safety portion is huge. It is hard to be an artist in a space where not only am I producing my art, I am working through what needs to happen behind the scenes, at the front of the house, and then also having to deal with racism on top of it. This gives us a little bit of room to just produce our art and breathe.
Reverend G, we've been focusing on the artistic side. There's also a business side, an innovation center element, an entrepreneurship side of things. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. In our innovation space, we are focusing on creatives, entrepreneurs, and leaders. And I think it's important to make that distinction because artists don't always think of themselves as entrepreneurs, or your traditional entrepreneurs don't think of artists as being entrepreneurs. But we have people who are physicians and department chairs of university departments who want to work remotely in Black space. And then we have creatives who want to showcase their art in our gallery and make it in our maker space, but come to our business, our innovation space, to put together a business plan where they may get, where they may receive mentorship, but also funding to support their efforts. And so for us, it's much broader than just co-working space, but it's where we offer professional and personal development. It's being designed by a local Black professional who manages a $7 billion enterprise here locally and bringing to bear all of the things that helped them to be successful and reputable and being able to live and carry out business above scrutiny. And so we have Black volunteers who want to bring the best of their knowledge to the table, and that will allow people to create what used to be just side gigs and to meaningful revenue generating options and enterprises that might make the difference between being able to afford a down payment on a home or sending their children to college. And we just believe that that's going to make a huge, huge difference. And this space is often thought about for adults, but we will have retired people in our senior center that can use this space. And also middle school, high school, and young adults will be able to use this space. And so there's a true intergenerational component to all of our programming that is really much needed.
Reverend G, I want to return to a question we've talked about over the years. There's been a political movement reaching into the White House, the Supreme Court, reacting against the idea of spaces focused on people of particular races, the idea that, hey, a center for Black people in this case reinforces racial divisions. If people are hearing this conversation and thinking along those lines, what would you say to them?
I would say that if someone holds that line, then they're upholding a concept where race really does matter. If you have to tell someone who looks like me, your race doesn't matter, then by default, you are saying that your race, your gender, your educational background is the standard, and the way business is being operated at a governmental level or local business level is the right way to do it. So I don't really spend a lot of time refuting that because it's beneath me. And I feel that they can find that information out someplace else. What I will say is this: when a country doesn't allow the beautiful melting pot of people to celebrate the flavor of the ingredient that they bring to the pot or to the stew, then they're creating a very bland pot that no one wants to drink from, no one wants to eat from, and no one wants to enjoy. But I also would say that while departments of universities are being challenged, libraries and books are being challenged, it is even more important for grassroots, community-rooted entities like ours to remind people that it is our background, our ethnic diversity that helped us to make this country great. It was not pretending to not be Black. It was being called Black because of who we were and how we looked. And in spite of all of that, we still helped to build America into a tremendous world superpower. But we are creating spaces where we embody the story. So take what you want to off the shelves and illegalize what you want to, but you can't illegalize me or Dana or others. We will embody the stories. We will be the voice of the playwrights. We are the playwrights. We will create a place where people are proud of what we've done and how we have built and how we have helped to make America great. And it's only when we have spaces to be our complete selves that we can bring our complete selves to the table. So Madison, Dane County, the state of Wisconsin, the nation will always hobble if people of color are being coerced to believe that who we are ethnically doesn't matter. It matters tremendously. And a sense of culture, what we do and how we do and with what we fight attacks against our personhood and our culture is key and is what we bequeath to the next generation. And so we just want to stress to folks that we're here and we're proud to be an American, proud to be Americans, but we're not going to deny what makes us ourselves. And so if people want to take them off the bookshelf, they can, but they can't take us off a bookshelf. And as long as we have breath in our bodies, we're going to honor our ancestors who are proud of who we are and whose blood and ingenuity and innovation and strength and grit resides inside of us. And we are part of what made America great. And we're going to continue to make America great in spite of steps to take us backwards.
And we'll leave it there. Reverend G, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
And Dana, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Reverend Alex G is president and CEO of the new Center for Black Excellence and Culture in Madison. Dana Pelaban is its director of performing arts. We ask you for your kite flying stories and tips ahead of an interview Friday with the Wisconsin Kiters Club.
And we heard from a listener named Rick who called in with some kite advice.
Get rid of that string and you go get some lightweight, like 20-pound fishing line. And then you go ahead and get yourself a nice spool so you can send that kite up there about 2,000 feet. It's a lot of fun, especially when you're a little kid.
I think Rick might be exaggerating the height a bit. The official height limit in Wisconsin is 150 feet. You got to get permission to go higher than that. Though the highest kite flight on record is 16,000 feet, set in New Zealand in 2014.
But Rick, we do appreciate the dual use for fishing line. Send us your stories about kite flying. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or call 888-642-0232 and leave us a message like Rick did.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Trevor Hook, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.